My name is Andy Sparhawk. I'm the Craft Beer Program Coordinator for the Brewers Association. I'd like to welcome you to Craft Brewers Conference. Thank you so much for coming. I have the distinct pleasure of introducing Ray Daniels, who is the founder of the Cicerone program. Ray's a internationally renowned author and beer educator, and basically started the program that I am now in the Brewers Association, which I work with Julia Herz in the craft beer program. So I have probably my job to thank Ray for. So thank you so much. And also, I'm a certified Cicerone, and the education that you provide is just changed how craft beer is being viewed in the world. So thank you so much. Ray's program is called What Bars and Bartenders Know About You Are Your Beers. And please join me in welcoming Ray Daniels.
There we go.
Thanks, Andy.
Thank you, Andy. Let's see. Let's get the other microphone turned on. Oh, that was mute. That's on. Okay. We good? So I like to wander, so I told him to give me a lavalier so I can wander. That's always good. Thank you, Andy. Yeah, I hope you didn't shudder too much when he slipped and said, "What bars and bartenders know about you?" We have a secret alliance with Google. We're collecting all of that. We know exactly what every single one of you... Yeah, no, we don't. Okay. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for coming out this afternoon. It's great to see such a big crowd. For those of you who were with us 15 years ago when the Craft Brewers Conference dwindled down to quite a bit smaller size, and this was the entire attendance, it's great to have a big crowds here now, and it's great to see so many people engaged with the business. Some of you may have seen the tweet I sent out this morning. We've got a conference with 11,000 people here. Last night at the opening reception, by the way, I thought that was one of the best opening receptions ever at a craft brewers conference. I don't know how many of you went, but it was a lot of fun. Able to get some food, able to get some beer. It's a great time. So I'm sitting down ringside in a bench, putting my feet up, relax a little bit. There's an empty spot next to me, but it's not easy to get to. I got it kind of blocked off from the aisle, sitting there relaxing, and suddenly somebody jumps down in the seat next to me. I'm like, okay, well, here it comes. Somebody saw me sitting here, wants to talk to me, so forth. Well, turns out somebody I didn't know, he didn't know me, no idea. We start chatting, and within 20 minutes, we're old friends. We got common ground. I think what he's doing cool, he thinks what I'm doing is cool. We're having a great time. And so after a half an hour, 45 minutes of talking, we're old friends in beer. And that is what craft beer is about, ladies and gentlemen. New friends in beer. Welcome to the Craft Brewers Conference. So I'm here to talk to you a little bit about what bartenders and bars know. I'm here to talk to you about our perspective we gained through the Cicerone certification program. A lot of you are probably familiar with it in one way or another. How many people in the room are certified at the first level or above? Thank you all very much. Great to have that group in the room. And we're going to talk about the program based upon our exam material. We're going to talk about the different topics that we test people on and how they perform. And this performance, how well people do or how poorly they do, helps us get a picture of what those bartenders, what those frontline servers are like out there, how much they know, how good a job they're doing at representing your beers when they're out there talking. So we're going to focus mostly on the first level exam. That's the Certified Beer Server exam. For those of you who haven't taken it or aren't familiar with it, it's a 60-question, multiple-choice, true-false question. And to date, we have given more than 50,000, this exam more than 50,000 times. And with the vast majority of the people taking the exam being resident in the United States, about 96% of them. And it wasn't this way initially, but in the last couple of years, about 50% of overall exam attempts are from people in the retail sector. So we are getting to the point where we're reaching those frontline folks very effectively. And just to give you an idea of the overall topics that are being covered, the certified beer server focuses primarily on the first two areas of our syllabus, keeping and serving beer and beer styles. These are the things that those frontline servers most need to know in order to be able to handle and present beer appropriately to customers, and also to be able to have a dialogue with customers in a meaningful way, to understand what they're interested in a beer, and to be able to present their bar or pub's offerings to that customer in a meaningful way. We do test them just a little bit on brewing process ingredients. I think we ask them one or two questions about malt and hops. That's about as far as we go on brewing process and ingredients for certified beer servers, and save most of that for the upper levels of the course. As you can see, the second level, certified Cicerone, begins to cover all five areas of the syllabus. There's still a little less emphasis put on brewing process and ingredients and on beer and food pairing than on the other service-related aspects of the syllabus. And then, of course, at the Master Cicerone level, we give equal coverage to all five areas of the syllabus. And so that's how we break down the content of these exams. As I mentioned, most of the candidates who take a certified beer server exam do come from the United States. They train or prepare themselves for the exam in a variety of ways. You know, one of the questions that we frequently get from people is, how do I take the course? How do I sign up for the class? And one of the things that some people don't understand about the Cicerone program is that we are a certification program first and foremost. And we do not require anyone to take classes from us before you take the certification exam. We have confidence in the certification exams. We know that they are difficult enough, that they assess skills and knowledge adequately, that if you can pass the exam, you deserve the certification that we are rewarding. And so we don't require anyone to take a class from us. We don't follow a model that says, sit down and take a course with us for 2 or 3 days, and at the end of it, we'll give you a little quiz and award you a certificate because you spent a few days with us in class. We let the exams stand on their own. And so we don't require anyone to take training from us, and we point people to various other sources of training. One of them that we point to a lot is my buddy Randy Mosier. He's got a book called Tasting Beer that we've recommended to many, many people. So lots of folks do that. They use self-education in one way or another to prepare for the exam. Of course, a lot of people have been in the industry long enough, been around long enough, had training of various other kinds, that they know plenty to pass the certified beer server exam, and so all they have to do is sign up and take it. Some large employers do offer their own training programs. They have a certified Cicerone or maybe even a master Cicerone on their staff that puts together a training program for their people and prepares those candidates. And there are some independent educators out there, some consultants, certified Cicerones or master Cicerones who run training courses for colleges, universities, local classes. And indeed, these days, lots of colleges and universities are getting into the business of doing brewer and beer training for our community. And so they are offering courses aimed at preparing people for certified beer server and even the certified Cicerone exam. So despite that basic mission that we are a certification program number one, education program number two, we do offer some training resources, in large part because after several years of saying, no, we don't offer training, you need to pursue it on your own, we finally decided it would really just be easier to develop some training programs and make them available to those who really insisted on taking some training for us. So we do offer some training now, and we've had our basic program of Beer Savvy, an online training program for the first level, available for almost 3 years now, and it's been a successful program for us, and yet still fewer than 15% of all the candidates who take the certified beer server exam go through one of our training programs, either Beer Savvy or one of our in-person classes that we do occasionally. So when you look at these results, remember that the training comes from a wide variety of sources. What we're really doing is looking at the true knowledge level of people out there who have taken this exam and passed, or even those perhaps who have not passed. So we're going to go through and look at certain question categories or topics. Here's some examples. Certain areas of beer styles. So for instance, in Belgium, we have it broken down into some style groups. We test on double and triple together. In German, we check German beer styles. We test on Hefeweizen, so forth. So we'll be talking about some topics, and I'll be telling you sort of what the mean or average score is in these topic areas. And in terms of those mean scores, the range of mean scores on any topic runs from as low as 55% to as high as 95%. So you know what a great score is for a topic and what a really poor one is. The average of the averages, if you will, the median on the midpoint amongst these topics, is about 83%. And so anything above that will be above average, and below that will be below average. So with that preamble, let's go ahead and get to some of the topics and questions that we ask people about. One of the first ones, real basic, is the three-tier system. How does it work? What do the players do? Who are they? And people do pretty well on this. The one point where there seems to be some confusion is what role importers play or where they are in the system. I think we ask who importers sell to in the three-tier system. And some people a little confused about that. Moving on to the issues of keeping and serving, maintaining quality beer and presenting quality beer to the consumer, we have the issue of skunking, light-struck beer. This is an important issue for beer drinkers. And we find that people pretty much understand that light causes a flavor change in beer. And because they understand that basic mechanism, they understand how to protect the beer largely, that cans, cardboard boxes, things like that are very useful, green bottles and clear bottles, not so great. And the interesting thing is they fail to sort of get how fast light-struck flavor can develop in a beer, that it's really just a matter of minutes, 1 or 2 minutes that this flavor develops. I remember one of the very first, probably was the very first craft brewers conference I went to in Austin, Texas in 1994, sitting in a beer garden with a brewer who was a friend of mine from Chicago, and our beers came and he took off his hat and was holding his beer over his hat. I'm like, "Tom, what are you doing with your hat?" It's like, "Shading my beer from the sun because otherwise it's going to get skunky." I was like, "Ah, baloney." I didn't believe him. And then I smelled my beer. Happens really quick. So, but people don't quite get that part of it. Oxidation and aging, best way to prevent that, refrigerate the beer, rotate inventory, keep it moving so it's not around for too long. What they're not really getting, and this is indicative of what we see across the panel here, is that the flavor aspect. If you ask them, what does an oxidized beer taste like? We're getting lower performance on that than we do on a lot of questions. Only 69 to 75% understand that aspect of it. And they don't necessarily really understand how air can damage their beer as well. And the other thing we see, not only at this level, but even, in fact, sometimes at certified Cicerone level, is some confusion between oxidized and light struck in terms of the mechanism of flavor development and where these two things come from. A lot of people think that oxidation leads to light-struck flavor or skunky flavor in a beer. Infection, dirty draft lines, people understand that draft beer can be bad. And I gotta say, this one really makes me happy because one of the reasons I started this program was because of my experiences in the early 2000s when I was working for the Brewers Association, running the craft beer marketing program, traveling around promoting American craft beers, and going into a bar that had 20, 30 taps, which was a lot back in that day, and getting a beer, and it was awful. It was coming from dirty lines. We had beer that just tasted terrible. And the servers having no comprehension whatsoever that such a thing was even possible, that just, what do you mean? You know, nobody else has complained about it. Everybody else drinks the beer just like that. It's always like that. American retailers used to have this sense that draft beer, or that beer in general, was kind of like a can of Campbell's soup. You know, take it home, you throw it in the cupboard, doesn't matter whether you open it next week or 3 years from now, it's pretty much going to taste the same, right? That's the way a lot of servers, a lot of retailers thought about beer. So I'm really pleased to see that we're getting through on that subject, that people understand at retail. They understand that beer can be bad, and they need to be aware of that, and they may have to do something about it. They understand the primary cause. Draft lines need to be cleaned regularly to avoid this. And again, key theme with these certified beer servers, they don't necessarily understand exactly what the flavor attributes are that indicate dirty lines or infected draft lines. And again, this is the first level. It's basic servers. Oftentimes, these are younger people who don't have that much experience with drinking beer. So getting a handle on those exact flavors is the toughest part for them to do. Draft mechanics, how to keep a draft system working properly. We don't test in a lot of detail on draft mechanics at the first level, but we do try and get a couple of basic concepts in there. And the most common one is that warm beer is the most frequent cause of foaming beer at the faucet. And we're doing a pretty good job of getting that through, that you gotta put the keg in the cooler for at least 24 hours before you put it on service. If you don't, there's a good chance it's going to be too warm and it's going to foam when you serve it. Also, that if all the other lines are pouring just fine and you've got one that's pouring badly, then warm beer should probably be your first suspect as a cause on that. Not so great on understanding what a coupler is. Not bad, but not fantastic on FOBs, foam on beer prevention devices. Beer savers that occur in a lot of long draw draft systems. Now again, part of the reason people aren't familiar with those is because they're not in every draft system. A lot of people probably have never seen one. But some of them, we in our program at least, we try and teach them how to reset them. We try and make them familiar with that. And they may get that, but they're still not really quite sure why that fob is there at all. It's like, okay, I know I got to mess with it when I go down and change a keg, but you know, what it's really doing, you know, not so clear on that. Glassware and clean glassware. This is definitely one of the things that when we teach, we hit pretty hard. Don't freeze your beer glasses. Use a glass rinser to rinse sanitizer out of the glass before you dispense beer in it. Selecting a glass, and at certified beer server level, we don't try and teach them really anything about the culture of beer and what shape of glass to choose. Mostly we try to get them to think about alcohol content and size of glass, right? Because you don't want somebody passing an 18% Imperial Stout across the bar in an Imperial pint glass, right? Either for responsible alcohol service or for economics of your operation, because probably it's not going to work out really well on either terms. So pretty basic on that stuff. Clean beer glasses, again, we teach and preach on that pretty hard, but not everybody goes through training, or the majority of people don't go through training on us. With us, and there's a number of different ways, as you probably know, to identify a beer clean glass, or a number of different things that can happen if the glass is not beer clean. So I think it's the complexity of that subject that causes a little bit poorer performance on that question. And then actually how to do a manual cleaning in a three-sink glass cleaning station, all the details of how to do that, we test really closely on that in the certified beer server exam. Which is kind of tough because a lot of those folks who are just wait staff who are never behind the bar are probably never going to wash a glass, but we still feel like they should know how to do it if they wind up being back there. So we do test really closely on that stuff, and we certainly want the people who are behind the bar to know how to do that properly. I would much prefer to get my beer in a clean glass than a dirty one. Pouring beer, pretty good on this one, 84 to 99. Not so great on understanding what to do with a yeasted bottle, with a bottle-conditioned beer. So that may be a great point of training anytime you get together with your retailers, or certainly something to mention. and size of foam head. Well, I can't really fault people too much on that one, right? How many of you know what the draft beer quality manual says as recommended foam head on a beer in the United States? What's it say? How much? How much head? An inch. An inch is right. You pass. But of course, you talk to any group of retailers about that, and they'll start shaking their heads because they know if they pass that beer across the bar with an inch of head on it, it's probably going to come back with a request for a top-up, right? And of course, my point is always, boy, I'd rather give them a top-up than pour a half pint of beer down the drain trying to get that foam out of the top of the glass, right? But you win some, you lose some. But because of the contention around the subject and because that one-inch standard just seems completely unrealistic to so many people, that's a tough question for people to get right. Talk a little bit more about brewing process and ingredients and flavor. We asked people about malt flavors, flavors that are associated with malt. They do pretty well on that. So they got that basic ingredient attribute down. That's a nice thing to see. They don't really understand where malt comes from. Again, you can't really blame them too much on that. But we are trying to get that process down of trying to help them understand where beer comes from, that ultimately it goes back to being an agricultural product. Hops. A lot of variability here. The toughest part is flavors. You know, what flavor words would you use to describe different types of hops, or if we give you hops with these flavor notes, what style group is that likely to come from? American, British, European, etc. And that's a tough area of performance for people at this level. Again, as we've seen on everything flavor-related for certified beer servers. Other questions about how they're grown, where they come from, things like that, do a little bit better. And I'll note one of the things here, that sentence probably doesn't make any sense to you, but we talk in testing about discrimination values with every question. And discrimination basically says, how good a job does that question do of predicting whether, that one question do of predicting whether this person who gets it right is going to pass the overall exam, all right? And so discrimination is just means that the people who pass usually get it right, and the people who fail usually get it wrong. It does a pretty good job of discriminating between those who are going to succeed and those who do not. And for whatever reason, we find that these hop questions have a very high discrimination value. They tend to be right by the people who pass and often wrong by the people who do not. Water and yeast. I think we really have a very basic question on this. They do well on yeast because it's a flavor-based question. They do not do well on. I think that's a tough question for a lot of people, even people who've been in the industry for a while, or certainly people who've been drinking beer for quite a while, often do not understand the flavors that come from yeast. Quantitative measures, solid on theory. They know the IBUs go to bitterness. Hallelujah. We're putting those IBUs in the beer for a good reason. They understand what ABV and SRM are. That's good. Where they fall apart is when we then try and get them to compare two different styles of beer and tell us which one is likely to have the higher IBUs or which one is likely to have the higher alcohol content. So that really goes more to style knowledge than it does to understanding these parameters. But it is, again, indicative of experience with styles and with beer in general. Speaking of styles, we test on various different style categories. We find that generally the most popular beer styles tend to be the ones that people understand the best. So here, the strong ones from the American styles, Imperial Stout, Double IPA, IPA, people do pretty well on those. Not so great on American lagers and wheat beers. And worst of all, an American Pale Ale, which I thought was really surprising. And I just wonder what the source of confusion is on American Pale Ale, or if we just wrote really hard questions about American Pale Ale. We'll have to dig into that a little bit more. In British beer styles, of course, the British beer styles we talk about most often are porter and stout. So guess what? Those are the styles that people do pretty well on. When it comes to bitter, Scottish ale, things like that, you know, people don't see those, people don't know about them, so they don't get that stuff very well. German beer styles, popularity holds true here. Kolsch is certainly one that a lot of American brewers make a version of. Maibach. Maibach is probably the hoppiest of the German lager styles, and so, of course, when American brewers want to make a lager, they oftentimes make a Maibach, so people have some familiarity with that. Doppelbock we get as a very common import in the United States, so that's pretty good on familiarity. Ditto with Hefeweizen. Poor Oktoberfest and Dunkel do the worst. Getting a fresh Dunkel in the United States is pretty damn hard to do these days. It's kind of like searching for a four-leaf clover. Apologies to any of you who do make one, and I know there are some of you who do, but in a lot of markets, it's really tough to go find one and to point people to it and give them a chance to become familiar with that style. And of course, Oktoberfest has a limited seasonal availability, so again, a lot of these younger people who are doing this have not had an opportunity to become familiar with it. Belgian styles, alcohol wins out again, doubles and triples. Have the best performance. Witbier, very popular style, lots of producers, does pretty well. Ditto with Saison, lots of folks out there doing that. No surprise that our sour beers, the Goose, Flanders Red, stuff like that, perform a little bit more poorly. And Blonde and Belgian Strong Golden don't do too well. And I think not too surprising, there's not too many Belgian blonde ales being produced by American brewers. And, of course, the phrase Belgian Golden Strong Ale never appears on the label of a beer, probably ever. And so for somebody whose primary experience has been drinking beers or serving beers and reading beer labels, that's a tough one to sort of get your hands around or head around. So overall conclusion on styles. People are pretty good understanding the key physical traits or knowing a key physical trait of a style. We try and get them high points of these things. But again, flavors are the shortcoming. If you try and ask them what's a key flavor of a Doppelbock, of a Hefeweizen, of a Belgian double, fall apart much faster on that stuff. And that's just experience and tasting those beers. Better sort of if you tell them a style and ask them a question about it than if we give them a constellation of characteristics and ask them what style that describes. That's a pretty tough question. And I don't think we do many of those at this level. I know we have several of them in the certified Cicerone exam, what I call sort of crossword puzzle exams, where we give you three or four very specific attributes of a beer and ask you to figure out what beer style it is from those from that information. So those are the servers, and that's what we see from the certified beer server exam. Talk a little bit about results from the certified Cicerone exam and how people do on that. Going to be a little less specific in terms of the details of individual questions because there's just too much information there to dig into. What we're going to talk about is overall topics and how candidates do in those areas. And what I did, first of all, Certified Cicerone being the second level tends to be more experienced people in the industry. We refer to a Certified Cicerone as a mature beer professional, somebody whose full-time job is beer. They're typically a beverage manager, beer manager at a retail operation, or they're a craft beer sales rep at a distributor, or they are a sales rep for a brewer themselves. And indeed, many brewery employees of various types, including brewers, have done the Certified Cicerone exam. In total, we have about, more than 1,600 Certified Cicerones in the world these days. For this, I went back and looked only at the 2014 data, which consists of a little over 1,000 total attempts at the exam, and a little over 400 people who actually passed. And that's pretty typical of our pass rate for the Certified Cicerone exam, right around 40% overall when we look at larger groups. So the exam itself is a three-hour exam. A three-hour written exam, and this consists of fill-in-the-blank and essay questions. There are no multiple choice. There are no true-false. It is the moment of truth, where there is a blank piece of paper there, well, a blank space at the end of the question, and you must come up with the answer and write it down. And we've talked about all that stuff. So I'm going to look at the overall score and the scores in five individual subject areas from individual exams. We showed you this a little bit earlier, the breakdown of content. In the Certified Cicerone, basically 50% of the content we're testing on is new content. It's stuff that we haven't touched on at all in the Certified Beer Server exam. Flavor and tasting, brewing process ingredients in much greater depth than we do it for Certified Beer Servers. And then, of course, beer and food pairing. And so there's a lot of new material in this exam. Now, when we send people their scores back from the Certified Cicerone exam, they get something that looks like this. This is sort of the box score, if you will, and this is just an example of what somebody would get. They have an overall score, the 82% there. We also break out separately their tasting exam score. Ultimately, that all of these other boxes are incorporated into the calculation for overall score. But we like to break it down a little bit and let them know how they did on individual parts of the exam. So we give them the tasting exam score. In this case, this candidate scored a 74. And then we break down the overall exam into the five subject areas or five topics that is the way we organize our syllabus, our overall body of knowledge. And so you can see this person got an 81 in keeping and serving, 77 on beer styles, 80 on beer flavor and evaluation, 95 on processed ingredients, and 80% on beer and food pairing. And that's just an example of how scores come out. So I thought what it would be interesting to do is to look at the population of candidates who passed the exam versus the population of candidates who did not pass the exam during 2014. And to look at the average scores in each one of these areas for those two populations. All right. So here's an example. Amongst candidates who passed, the average overall score was 84%. Amongst the candidates who did not pass, the average overall score was 71%. All right. Pretty significant difference between those two populations. And a little bit of quick math, we can see that the difference between the passing group and the non-passing group is about 13 percentage points between those two. So we see the gulf between those two populations on overall score. And we can apply this to each one of these areas of the exam results. So if we go and look at the tasting exam, for instance, the average tasting exam score amongst candidates who passed the exam overall was 83%. The average tasting exam score amongst candidates who did not pass overall was 67%. So an even wider gulf here between the passing group and the non-passing group of 16 percentage points between those two groups. All right. So this is the basic vehicle to look at sort of what those certified Cicerones know, where their strengths are, what they know well, versus those who do not pass the Certified Cicerone exam. So I've just got a chart here. We've got this difference between those who passed and those who didn't in the right-hand column. Then we'll have the topic or the area of the exam over here in the left-hand column. And if we look at the differences, you can see the range runs from a high of 16% to a low of 10%. Start at the bottom and see what's easiest, what people seem to do all right on. Well, these are beer and food pairing and keeping and serving beer. Kind of interesting. So keeping and serving beer is one of the old topics. It's one of the things we test at certified beer server level, right? It's stuff that we've been training both through the certified beer server level and the certified Cicerone level if people have been working with us, or even if they've been studying the syllabus. It's stuff that's been on the syllabus throughout both levels of the exam. So not too surprising that whether you pass or not, you're doing about the same on the keeping and serving beer, or at least, if not about the same, closer in this area than in some others. Beer and food pairing. Well, beer and food pairing, I often refer to as the squishiest part of the Cicerone syllabus, all right? Beer and food pairing is pretty subjective. Beer and food pairing is one of those things that's often in the mouth of the beer holder, if you will. And one of the reasons we only count beer and food pairing for 10% of the score at certified Cicerone level is because of the squishiness of that subject, the subjectivity of assessment in this area. There are some basic principles to beer and food pairing that most experts agree on. Those are the things we test on pretty closely. And we do ask them to do some pairings and come up with some things, and we try to assess those as generously as possible. So again, not too surprising that this is an area where there's not huge differences between those who pass and those who do not. So overall difference we've seen is 13%. In this middle area are ingredients and process and beer flavor and evaluation. These are a little bit tougher topics for candidates. The score for beer flavor and evaluation actually includes the tasting exam score, and so it's not surprising that those two are nearly equal in their content, because, as I say, the tasting exam itself does make up a big part of that overall content. So, well, if you've been keeping track, you know there's one thing missing from this list, and that's beer styles. And I say this frequently to candidates who are studying for the exam, that beer styles are the toughest part of the certified Cicerone exam. This is the language of beer. It's how we talk about beer. It's how we understand what attributes the beer are likely to have. And it's one of the most important parts of being a beer professional and being in a position to talk about beer with brewers, with consumers, with retailers, whatever role you're in. And there's a bit of an aura. We say that beer styles only count for 25% on the overall exam breakdown, but there's also some beer style issues in the tasting exam. So if you're not strong on beer styles, you're probably going to have some trouble with some portion of the tasting exam as well. So it's got a little bit bigger impact than just the beer style section. Same thing with pairing, actually, too. Because we typically, when we ask you to pair a beer with a particular food, we ask for, in some cases, we just ask for a style, to give us a style that would pair well with that food. If you don't understand those styles well, you're going to have a tough time coming up with a correct selection on that stuff. So beer styles is hugely important. Strong style knowledge and capability is a key to doing well on this exam. And those folks who have passed the certified Cicerone exam certainly have excellent style knowledge. I'd say it's impossible to get past this exam without having that one way or the other. So that is it for my prepared analysis on this stuff. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about that content, anything else related to beer knowledge, beer training, et cetera. I know we've got some microphones for questions.
Hi. Hey. Thank you, by the way, for all this information. It's awesome. I did have a couple comments. When we studied for our Cicerone exam, we did it with our distributor, and it was a fantastic experience. They learned a lot. We learned a lot from them. Because of that, they made a lot of changes in the way that they handle, especially like on-site. Mm-hmm. If they get a complaint about a beer being bad, they all carry like hand pumps now, so that they can prove it's not.
Test from the keg,
the line, or whatever.
Yep.
But they've made a lot of changes in the way that they do it because of that.
That's great.
I do have a couple suggestions. I think that a lot of times the servers don't really have much support from the managers of their facility or whatever about studying for it. They don't still get like why it's important and why they need to know.
Right.
So I think that maybe having like a certified beer server trainer certification that would allow maybe us in the industry or you know someone to actually train them on what they need to know, specifically with beer styles and keeping and serving beer, et cetera. I also think that it might be a good idea to do a certified craft beer taster mm-hmm. certification? Because as you said, like with the head and the some of the complaints that we get, as people are coming to craft beer more, they're right. learning about it, but they're learning about it from, you know, their big IPA friend or their, you know what I mean? They're not, right. they don't really have a good source of information.
Right.
So maybe having like the certified, you know, beer judge, that kind of thing that would certify them as a taster,
mm-hmm.
something like that. So
great.
And that is like one of the hardest exams I've ever taken, by the way. So thank you. But if you're going to be an expert, you should be an expert. So
yeah.
it was an awesome experience.
Good. Thank you. Well, yeah, we hope that whether you pass or fail when you take the exam, when you look back on it, you realize that you learned a hell of a lot in studying for the exam. And, you know, ultimately, that was the real goal of this program. Certification, one way or the other, I could care less. What I care about is we have a more educated community selling beer, right? And that was the big goal here, was to set up some goals, to set up some mileposts for people to shoot at and to say, I want to get to this. Well, how do I get to this? Oh, I have to learn more about beer. Aha! That, ultimately, was the goal. And when I was first starting out, some of you may know Sam Merritt, who was a beer educator in the New York area. He's now a beer distributor out in Las Vegas, certified Cicerone. When I first started out, Sam had just launched a beer education company, and he called me up and said, well, I guess we're competitors. And I said, no, Sam, we're not. He says, what do you mean? It's like, you're a beer educator. I'm a beer certifier. I test people. And Sam got it, like, immediately. He's like, oh, so if I find a bar that wants to get all their guys certified, now there's a goal. Now there's a place they're trying to get to, and I can offer them the training to get to that goal. I said, bingo, exactly. Before, when Sam went in to sell training, he'd sell the bar, hey, you know, you guys, you should get your service trained. Okay, fine, yeah, let's do that. Yeah, let's do an hour of training. And Sam would be like, oh, man, they can't really learn anything in an hour. You know, we gotta do more than that. Well, how much? And Sam would be like, 10 hours. And the boss would be like, 2 hours. And, you know, so ultimately they take the certified beer server exam and say, hey, we want to get certified beer server. What's it going to take to get our folks trained to that level? It's a goal. It's a place to get to. And so educators are able to use that as a tool and say, all right, I will get your folks prepared to take that exam. And so that's definitely been one of our goals. We also decided early on to focus on people in the business. On beer professionals. And I think that's a key decision for us, not to spread ourselves too thin, not to try to be something to everyone. And the idea of doing a craft beer taster is interesting and appealing, but I think it does maybe take us off of our mission of appealing to professionals. We do offer some flavor and taste training products now. We actually also offer a very short beer server training class in Chicago these days. It's 4 hours, and we're actually seeing a fair number of consumers coming in to do that class just because they want to learn the basics of beer and a little bit about beer service. And one of the things we're talking about is franchising that class out to certified Cicerones to be presenters out there in the marketplace. So that, I think, would take the place of that a certified server. It'd be a way for people to get a really informed introduction to that part of the service. So, but thank you for the comments and questions. I've got staff in the audience that's taking notes and helping me remember this stuff. So, we'll get back to that and think about it as well. Yes, sir.
So I see one of the challenges is to try to get our servers to be motivated to do this, to actually be knowledgeable.
Yes.
Have you guys compiled any statistical information on the monetary success, you know, the gain to be made in knowing these beer products? So that servers actually make more money. So they'd say, okay, if I can make, you know, an estimated larger income each year, yes, I will go do this, and I'll practice it and see if it works for me. So, and you know, because we're often just saying, we'd like you guys to know more about our beers and also the other beers we bring in, and you want to be able to field questions. So is there a statistic to say, yes, those servers can make more money?
Not that we have. No, we haven't compiled that, and that would be a great project. We should probably find a retailer and try and do a before and after with them. Anecdotally, I believe it's true, but
right.
Yeah, no,
exactly.
No,
yeah,
we don't have it. And you know, I think some of the proof is in the pudding these days when you see you know, major national organizations, hotel chains, Disney, Princess Cruise Lines, people like that adopting this. you know that they're finding value in it, or they would not be investing that money in it. Those are smart people that are not burning that money. So, but it's hard to get the individual server to see that payoff.
Exactly.
Yeah. That'd be a great study to do. We'll have to see if we can get a. And if anybody's got the case study data, we'd be happy to help you out. Yeah. Yeah, well, that's a common resolution. He said, we just told them that if they didn't have it by May 1st, they weren't going to get shifts anymore. There are many different ways to motivate servers, and that is certainly one of them. Recommendation, or?
We just give them a raise.
Yeah.
That seems to be the biggest motivator because...
Right. Get a little more every hour. Okay, that's great. Yeah, and I know different companies have different ways of doing it. Sometimes it's, you don't get the premium shifts or you don't get priority in scheduling. There are lots of ways beyond the altruistic, you'll learn more about beer, enjoy your job more, and maybe make money in the long run. Just in the short run, you're not going to get the shifts you want unless you've jumped through this hoop. Question here.
Yeah, I was curious about the data that showed that higher ABV beers seem to test better in terms of knowledge set out there for professionals. I was wondering, we're used to thinking about the fashion of certain beer styles on the consumer side. We don't usually think about that on the professional side nearly as much. I wonder if you have any thoughts as to where that's coming from, and also whether or not that creates a bias in the overall growth of certain styles at the expense of others in the long run.
Yeah, great question. I don't think so is my answer to that in terms of the bias. I think what's happening is that those are the styles that are getting the most attention right now. You look at double IPA, Imperial Stout, things like that. They are super popular in the marketplace, have been. And if you're a young server, people are asking you about that stuff all the time. That's what your friends think is cool. That's probably the stuff you're getting into. And that's my explanation. That's my supposition for that. I suppose we'd have to dig into it in more detail to find out for sure if that's what it was all about. But certainly seems to be a good match there with name popularity of those brands. The things you hear all the time, Wit, Saison, double, triple, IPA, those are the things that did really well. The things that had obscure, unusual names are the things that, are not doing particularly well up there. So I think that's a pretty strong correlation. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Is there a possibility to have it in Spanish in the future?
Question is there a possibility to have this in Spanish in the future? Absolutely. Last year, we did our first foreign language translation into French. Everybody in the room is going, French? What the hell are you doing it in French for? I have one simple answer, Canada. So we launched in Canada a couple of years ago. We're trying to be, a good citizen in Canada. A bunch of people up there speak French, so we did the program in French. We also happen to have a master Cicerone who's French-Canadian and fluent in French, so it was a lot easier to get that translation done. We started working on Spanish last year and just didn't have the resources to do it. We're hoping to tackle that late this year or in 2016. But yes, Spanish, full program in Spanish is on our priority list, just not at the top of it right this minute. But definitely something we want to do. One of the things, and I don't know how aware you guys are of this, but the American craft beer movement is being exported all over the world right now. You go to Europe, and you're seeing American-style pale ales, American-style IPAs, American-style double IPAs being brewed by local startup breweries in every country in Europe and in Latin America at this point, South America. And so the American craft beer movement is actively being exported, and what we're finding is that people in those countries who are getting excited about American craft beer start looking into it, hear about Cicerone, then call us, and they want Cicerone to be a part of what they do as well. So we're getting calls on a weekly basis for various translations of the program. It's in our 2-3 year plan at this point, but it's not something we can do overnight, unfortunately. So we're making progress, but yes.
As far as seeing where the people that are actually taking the test are coming from, mm-hmm. Do you have data on that? So obviously if you walk into a place like Falling Rock or Hopleaf or someplace that's really known for beer, I'm sure that there's definitely more people coming from those, feeding from that. But are you getting a response from, Buffalo Wild Wings or, corporate companies that are also really focusing
right.
on, you know, a wide variety of craft
beer? Yeah, that's a great question. So the question is about the source of where people are taking it. There are only a limited number of required fields when people register. Even their industry affiliation of distributor, retailer, or brewer is an optional field. So like when I said 50% are retail, that's 50% of the, like, 30% of the people who actually answer that question are retailers. We just assume that it applies to the rest of the population. When it comes to specific companies, we don't require anybody to identify their company. We did improve it about a year ago where if people go to enter a company, it does drop down a list, a context-sensitive list that says if you start to type, Ruby Tuesdays, then you type in RU and it's going to pull up all the things that start with RU. So hopefully everybody from that company will wind up clicking on the same thing and they'll all be the same so that when we do search the database, we'll actually be able to find it. But until about a year ago, if people put in a company designation, it was how they typed it, spelled it, and which name they chose to do. And, you know, some of these chains have various different names for the corporate parent, and they put in the store name and all this stuff. So you try and go search for something, like Boston Beer, for that matter. You know, some of the people put Sam Adams, some of them put in BBC, some of them put in Boston Beer. And so trying to authenticate that Boston Beer has X number of certified beer servers, certified Cicerones, was a nightmare for us in terms of trying to go through and look at that stuff. So sadly, no, we don't have good data on that stuff. We know anecdotally, oftentimes, who we have worked with, who has used the program. Some people, rather than going through the website, do bulk purchases with us directly, cut us a check, and send that, so we know that via our just accounting and stuff. But because it is a web-based business for the vast majority of what we do, a lot of times we sell, I mean, we've had customers we've sold 500 certified beer server exams to, and if they don't put in the corporation name when they make that purchase, we don't really know who they're from. Anecdotal. I mean, it's mostly on-premise, but we do have some partners on the off-premise side that have been very active. Is it more wine? That's the
Total Wine.
Thank you. Sorry. Yes, Total Wine have been a big participant out here in the West. But you know, after that one, I'm kind of like I'm not sure that I could name any others that I know for sure have been active in it. Well, in truth, no, but it's something we would be willing to consider and think about. I think the challenge is that the program requires knowledge of draft and the on-premise service stuff. And I, you know, from very early on, I had people that were from the off-premise sector and would object to that and say, well, I would do this, I would love to have this, but I don't want to learn all that draft stuff. I'm never going to have to use it. I work in a liquor store, it's family owned, I'm never going to work anywhere else. And my point was, you know, I'm sorry, we'd love to have you, but if we're going to make you particularly a certified Cicerone, that means you're a mature beer professional. And if you walk into a bar or somewhere else and you say, identify as certified Cicerone, they should be able to expect you to help them with their draft problem, even if that's not what you do day in and day out. I'm a little less rigid on that for certified beer servers, just because it's less of the content and so forth. But these days, you walk into liquor stores, they're filling growlers, they've got tasting rooms. Freaking, you go to Whole Foods, you can buy a beer and walk around with it on your cart. You know, they got cup holders on the carts now. So I think people who 5, 6, 7 years ago when we started said, oh, I don't need to know draft stuff, I don't need to know on-premise stuff because that's never going to be a part of my world, it is now. And so I think I've been vindicated somewhat of saying, yes, we do expect you to learn the details, or at least details appropriate for your level in the program about draft, because it may be a part of your job. So, yes, sir.
All right. I have a obvious question coming from me, but it has to do with, can you go into more detail why American Pale Ale style scored the worst? And then secondly, how do you pick what type of beers you use for the tasting? And then as far as the spikings, what do you go 2 times, 3 times threshold?
Yeah, okay, sure. Help me, you'll have to help me remember all those if I get lost. What was the first one again? Pale ale. Yeah, I don't know is the answer to that. And my suspicion is that we're probably asking really hard questions about pale ale because in my mind, that's such a standard style that everybody ought to know a lot about it. And what I haven't done is go back and look at in detail at the questions because this is just a topic and there's a multiple questions addressing that topic.
Do you think a little of that is because the American pale ale style has kind of, gone down but also swayed in hoppiness, I would say? Since, you know, the 80s.
Entirely possible. Yeah. And I don't know, I see my my content manager, Pat Fahey, over there pulling out his computer. He's probably looking at those questions right now. So we may have more insight on that in an hour or so. Yeah. So second was picking the beers for the tasting. Yeah, so I have to be careful about how much I say about that because there are exam candidates in the room, and we don't want to give away our secrets. So there are three sections to the Certified Cicerone Tasting Exam. Section number one is off-flavor identification. You get five cups, and four of them are unknowns. One of them is a control, the base beer that you're comparing everything against. It's all the same beer. We typically use a lager of some sort, Stella, Amstel, well, not Amstel, Stella these days. I don't know what else we're using, Pat.
Amstel Light is
pretty common. Okay, we are using Amstel. We try and go with something fresh anyway. Three of those four samples will be spiked. One of them will be same as control. And we do give the candidates a list of the possible off flavors that might be in there. But there's like six off flavors listed, and only three of the samples are going to be spiked. So they have to taste the sample, decide if it's spiked, and then identify the spike correctly based upon the prompts that they have available. So here we're trying to assess, can they detect the off flavor? And can they identify it properly once they detect it, all right? There are other places on the certified exam where we ask them, we give them the name of a flavor and ask them to identify what attributes, how you would describe that flavor. So we get at this flavor stuff in a couple of different ways. At this point, we're just like, if it's there, can you detect it, and can you tell us which one it is? Spiking level on that is 4.2 times threshold. We use the Aroxa flavors. Their standard instruction is for one capsule in 1 liter, and that gives you a 3 times threshold sample. We use one capsule in 2 bottles of beer, and so that gives us an effective 4.2 times threshold. Typically, those levels are somewhere between obvious to overwhelming, and in fact, that's what we ask our proctors to rate them as: faint, evident, obvious, or overwhelming as the presence of the in the sample in the particular beer. And typically, as a proctor, when I'm tasting along, I don't even taste those samples. You can tell, you know, from this far away smelling them what they are. Again, we're trying to make sure that if it's there, do you know what to call it? Can you associate the right word with it? Acuity is something that comes later. It's a different sort of thing. We've got actually different products we're introducing here to get at taste panel training for breweries at that three times threshold level. So that's the first part of the exam. Second section of the tasting exam is style discrimination. 4 samples here. For each one of these, you're given 1 beer, and you're given a 50-50 question. We might give you a nice golden, pale to golden beer, and you're supposed to taste it and tell us, is this a German Pilsner or a German Helles? Okay. By appearance, it could be either one. We want to know, by flavor, can you distinguish between those two things? So obviously, we have to have one of those two styles for each one of those questions. Based upon our experience, we have a database now of, I don't know, probably 100 or 150 different pairs and what the beer was we were presenting and how candidates have scored on those things. And we rate each pairing as easy, moderate, or hard. And typically we try to make one of the four easy, two of them moderate, and one of them hard so that there's a mix of sample difficulties amongst those four. We also try to mix the origin of the beer styles, so we don't wind up with 4 Belgian or 4 German or something like that. Whenever possible, we try to do 1 American, 1 German, 1 Belgian, 1 British. amongst those four. So we're assessing your style discrimination ability across all four of the major cultural beer groups. The last set of tasting questions are what's called beer acceptance. And the model question here is we give you a beer, we identify both the brand and the style, and so here's a beer, it's an American Pale Ale, it's Sierra Nevada Pale Ale. Customer ordered this beer and they don't think it tastes right. Your job is to determine, is the beer flawed in some way? And if so, what is it? And should it still be on service? And if it's not, you know, what should you do to correct it? And we actually give twice as many points for those questions because there's a lot more information, a lot more judgment involved there on those questions. And again, blend of styles, blend of weights on there. We sometimes spike those beers. We sometimes don't. And I always tell candidates, anything goes on the beer acceptance questions. You know, could be wrong beer, could be not carbonated, could be dirty lines, could be skunked, anything goes, literally. You don't know anything about where that beer came from, how it got in that glass. All you know is it was served under that name and title. Is there a problem? So that's the basic structure of the questions. And again, we've kept track of what we do on those things and how people do and do that. Typically these days, in addition to our proctor prepping those samples and tasting them, to ensure objectivity of the assessment by the program, we have a certified Cicerone who's already passed the exam, who is not involved in preparing the sample, so they don't know what they are, basically come in and sit down and take the tasting exam at the same time as the candidates and score the exam, and we use the input from that certified Cicerone to assess then whether we achieved our goal in preparing those samples and whether the candidates did in fact get the kinds of samples we intended for them to get in the process. So I see Andy's giving me the thumbs up, which means more like cut it off. Thank you all for coming today. Thanks very much. Cheers.